You're the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari, Season 1, Episode 3. Hi, I'm Randy Cantrell. Welcome to the Year of the Peer Podcast with Leo Battari. This podcast is based on a simple truth. Who you surround yourself with matters. Author and keynote speaker Leo Battari will interview thought leaders from all walks of life who will share how they leverage peer advantage and show you how engaging your peers more purposefully can hold the key to greater success in business and in life. This week, our guest is Lewis Schiff. Lewis Schiff is the author of Business Brilliant, Surprising Lessons from the Greatest Self-Made Business Icons, the executive director of Business Owners Council, and the co-founder with Norm Brodsky of Ben Global Mentorship that helps business owners transform their companies into scalable enterprises and eventually enduring institutions with help from rockstar entrepreneurs from around the world. Leo, let's get started.
Well, thanks, Randy. Lewis Schiff, welcome to the Year of the Peer podcast. Great to have you here.
Oh, thank you, Leo. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, I want to get right into it because I know you have really so much to offer on this topic. So let's go ahead and dive right in. You know, as a entrepreneur, as a mentor, as a business founder and all, you have been involved with kind of peer-to-peer learning for quite some time, and would love to know kind of what got you started down that path. What got you interested in it right out of the gate?
Well, it starts with a confession, and the confession is I don't think I really understood what the word entrepreneur meant till about 10 years ago. I had been one for 20 years up to that point, but I don't think I fully grasped what the word meant. So today, what I can tell you, having thought about it a lot and written about it, researched it, formalized it, is that there is no entrepreneurship without mentorship. I mean, they exist in parallel because for the most part, the skills you have to learn to succeed as an entrepreneur come from paying attention to the people who came before us. And one of the companies that I run is called Ben Global Mentorship, which is named after Ben Franklin, because we consider Ben Franklin sort of the original prototype of the American style entrepreneur. And that if you think that's true, then you realize that every entrepreneur that's come since Ben Franklin, I call him Ben, Ben Franklin is...
You're on a first name basis.
Yeah, we're pals. He's the third founder of the company, but he has no equity, but he's still helpful. And so everything that's happened, every great thing you've seen or heard about in entrepreneurship is a function of mentorship. And that mentorship dates back to the people who came before you, before them, before them, before them, to Ben Franklin. And so I guess I realized that if I was going to be an entrepreneur, I was going to have to be a good mentee. I'm really hot on what it means to be a good mentee. But of course, as you get a little older, wiser, and grayer, you start to become a mentor inevitably as well. And I hope I've grown into that role just as well.
What's great, though, is that over time, in courses a little while back now, I think you mentioned it was about 2009 when you started the Business Owners Council, because there's a recognition that there's not just a mentor-mentee relationship, but there are people that can learn from one another and do learn from one another very effectively. So tell us a little bit about how that, kind of came together for you.
Sure. So the Business Owners Council is a real world experiment of research I did in 2005 for a book called The Influence of Affluence. And so what I was doing in that book was we looked at 3,000 people who started out life in the middle class and remained in the middle class throughout their money earning years. And then about 700 people who had started out life in the middle class and had gone on to become extremely wealthy. And we asked them all the same questions and we compared the differences. How do 700 people emerge out of the middle class? And most of us tend to stay in the group we started in. And one of the four most important answers was the ways that they managed relationships. So we call it networking, which is a very simple word, means different things to different people. But, you could call it mentorship, you can call it networking. It really has to do with how you decide to interact with another person. So I interviewed a guy named Russell Simmons, who's a really great entrepreneur who built a couple of really hot companies, Fat Farm and things like that. And he has this phrase, which is good givers are great getters. Good givers are great getters. And that could sound like a cute phrase, but what it really means is if you've identified the right person or group of people that you can get something from, the very best approach is to give a lot of wisdom, a lot of attention, a lot of your time, which is the most valuable resource you have. If you find the right group of people to give to, you'll probably get a lot more back in return. And so what I did with the Business Owners Council after the research I had done is I worked with a magazine called Inc. Magazine, one of the great, great magazines that covers entrepreneurship, and asked them to help me create a group of people who, if they were in the room with each other, would know how to give a lot to each other because they would understand, as all, you know, self-made people do in America, understand that if you have to be a giver in order to be a getter in business terms. And so it wasn't hard. We put a lot of high performing business owners in the room, and they looked around the room and then identify a person or two or five, and they would go to them and they'd say, who are you? What are you about? What's important to you? You know, in their own informal ways. And then they would follow up with leads, with ideas, with solutions. And they were helping each other. And it wasn't altruism. It was the basic understanding that you must give to the right groups of people in order to get a lot in return. And that's the energy, the business model even behind the Business Owners Council that I run today.
So that becomes foundational that you at least adopt that point of view. What are some of the other things that you believe make people successful in that group setting? I mean, what you've seen over the years, people who've really benefited from being in a group, what separates them from people who get less benefit from?
Sure. And I'll give you three. One of them is basically finding the right group of people and being very giving to that group. And the right group of people, if I was willing to, I would put that word in air quotes, because the right group matters a lot. The right group matters a lot. And we have a whole module that we teach everyone on how to pick the right people. But that's important because a lot of people walk into a room and they don't know how to connect with people. They don't know how to ask for what they want. They don't know how to give. They don't know the power of giving. The second thing is, just like you should spend a lot of time giving to the right group of people, you should also find a way to orient your day, your business day, around the thing you do best. That's something I could go on and on about, the power of that, about how important it is to maximize the amount of time you spend doing the thing you do best. And what do I mean by the thing you do best is really important. I mean, the thing that you're better at than most people around you, that the marketplace values. If you're really good at something that other people are not good at, but the marketplace doesn't value it, it doesn't matter. You have to find the intersection between the thing you're better at that the marketplace values the most. And then in some ways, the essence of entrepreneurship is maximizing that value. So what I mean is, if you're really good at something and the marketplace values it, if you're a salaried employee at $100,000 a year, that's one thing. But if you can find a way to become maybe a salesman of that or an owner of a company who does that thing, you're maximizing your value in the marketplace moving upstream. So people who learn how to spend the most time doing the thing they're best at and extracting the most value from the marketplace are also very, very successful. I could tell you stories about guys like Howard Schultz at Starbucks, all these really important people who that's their MO. That's how they do it. So that's the second thing. And then the third last one is pivoting. We hear about this a lot, but it's persevering in the face of adversity. It's when things don't go your way, it's learning how to listen to what didn't work, being very thoughtful and very kind of precise about what didn't work, and then addressing those things head on and trying to, you know, make decisions, maybe change them, maybe stop doing it, but listening to it. And if you look at all three of those things, you know, playing in the right network, doing what you do best, and persevering in the face of adversity, I could also tell you why the middle class has trouble with all three of those things. They tend not to know how to find the right networks. They tend to spend time they're comfortable with, not time with people they want to be like. They tend to be told what to do by their bosses as opposed to finding a way to do what they do best all the time. And when adversity comes their way, they tend to give up. Those are three things that the middle class tends to do in my research that stop them from succeeding. And if you want to know why roughly 10% of the American public have pulled together net worths of 7 or 8 or 9 figures, it's because they do those three things better than most.
You know, and I think the second one I always found really interesting, because it isn't so much, to your point, doing what you love. It's also doing what you love that really has value in the marketplace, which I think in some respects is related to, you know, a quote that, you know, I pulled that you had written or you often talk about, which is many of us may do what we love and hope the money will follow.
Right.
The people who are really successful do what they love and they follow the money.
Exactly.
So maybe you could give us an illustration of that. Who did that really, really well? And try to paint a picture for our listeners on that.
Yeah, I will. I really love to talk about Howard Schultz from Starbucks, because Howard is the CEO of obviously a very diverse and complicated global corporation, Starbucks, in, you know, all over the world. However, if you spend time with him, he'll tell you that he loves, and his greatest source of energy is the role that coffee has played in history to bring people together. You could so easily laugh that off and say, what's that got to do with what you did this morning? But he'll tell you that he set out from the beginning to recognize that coffee had this way of bringing people together for the right reasons. Peace treaties are negotiated over coffee, and people fall in love over coffee, and people become friends over coffee, and business deals are struck over coffee. That he just noticed that coffee was a common and binding thing, that I might say to you, Leo, let's go get a cup of coffee. You know, that's just the way we are. And so he set out very early on to create Starbucks into what he calls the third place. You've got your home, you've got your office, now you have a third place where you can connect with other people over coffee. The reason why that's important is that because that was his thing, that was the thing he wanted to do more than anything else, he had to create supply chains and business that stretched all the way to South America, all the way to America to make that work. And he had to create a workforce 200,000 strong in order to deliver that coffee. And he had to create an international retail strategy. Every single thing he's done ties back to the fact that he thinks the more his greatest contribution to the world that he does better than anything is create the place where we meet over coffee. That's it. That's a really big vision, right? And a huge outcome. But you might say, well, I'm really good at creating rapport with people, you know? And so you're going to want to create a business life where somehow creating rapport with people is the thing you do really well and the thing you're paid for. Sometimes we call it sales. Sometimes if you're in a creative messaging business, right, like you were, it's about understanding the needs of the customer really well and translating that into a creative expression. Whatever your thing is, building your business around that. And I like Howard's example because he never planned on building a 25,000 store chain. I mean, of course not. Who would think that they would set out in life to do that? He said, my biggest vision was to have 100 stores. That was the full extent of my vision one day, that would be a huge success. But in fact, he is so good at what he does. And he has not yet found the point at which the marketplace doesn't value it. He keeps going.
You know, it's interesting too. There's a lot of entrepreneurs that will call Starbucks their office, as you well know.
The third place. Also,
now that you're not in a Starbucks now, of course, but tell us where you are now.
I'm in a modern version of Starbucks in a way. I'm in a place called WeWork. WeWork has a simple idea, actually not even an original idea, to create collaborative workspaces. And I'm just here because I'm passing through visiting an associate, and then I had the chance to speak with you. I asked for a quiet room. But every day, a lot of really creative people, whether they're startup entrepreneurs or consultants, this whole consulting class that's emerged, wanted a place to work that reminded them of the workplace, you know, with the coffee maker and with the place where you bumped into other people at the water cooler. But they were younger and they wanted it to be much cooler than it would have ever been in the past. And so WeWork comes around and says, we're going to build a cool place for people to work. Because working and doing startups is kind of like being the hippies in the old days. You know, it used to be I'm a hippie. Now you say I'm a startup guy 40 years later. And so it's a lifestyle. And they created a lifestyle work environment. I would have, to be honest, I would have told them it was a really dumb idea if they had told me it. But I would have been wrong. They would have been right. It's a great idea. Now there are these WeWorks all over the country. And they're considered cool places to work. Who would have thought that phrase would have ever existed?
Well, I think about what it does, because obviously being an entrepreneur, and especially if you're starting up your own company, it can be very isolating.
Yeah.
And to be around, and I've heard in so many places like WeWork and other similar situations where people meet one another and there are business relationships formed and there are things that happen in those collective spaces that is rather extraordinary. And, it's really great to see.
Well, you know, there's a great one in Chicago called 1871. It's actually an incubator.
Yes.
You know 1871?
I do. In fact, the artwork on the podcast is from 1871. I participated in a panel there. And, I think what you'd agree, the energy of that place is just palpable, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you walk into 1871, it's just really extraordinary. But tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, the reason I like it as an example, it's an incubator. So let's say 200 or 300 companies are coming in. It's huge. A couple hundred companies are housed there. But what they do is they say, you know, I think they probably give them a little something, a little money, maybe some free space. So you have to earn your way in. But once you're in, you know, inevitably a lot of those 200 startups fail, as they should. But what 1871 does is they say, okay, this failed, but Leo really performed well in his portion of the business. Let's put them together with another guy who performed really well in their portion of business, but they failed too. And let's see if those two can come up with something. So now, you know, they're not just providing me a desk and Wi-Fi. Now they're leading me along the channel that'll lead to my ultimate network and helping me pull that together and encouraging me to do what I do best and helping me pivot through adversity. So they're like hitting all three of my favorite buttons in terms of, you know, what we need to do to succeed as individuals.
You know, what's really great about your work is not only as an entrepreneur and a mentor, but as an author, I think you've used really being an author and a writer to extend your reach, to extend what you've learned to others, which is so incredibly valuable. Obviously, one of your many books, Business Brilliant, I really loved the 7 principles there. And I guess I'd like to focus on 2 of them because I want to see if in your mind they're related.
Okay.
Oftentimes, I think when people participate in peer groups, the skills they learn and participating in those groups effectively can really help them in terms of leading higher performing teams in their organization. So when I look at your 7 principles and I see one of them is cultivating networks, right, mm-hmm. and how important and valuable that is, and then, of course, to building teams. Do you see those as related? And how does that, you know, feel for you, at least in the context of the way you created the principles you defined in the book?
Yeah, you know, team building is, you know, presumes that you're sort of at the top of the team or you're one of the people at the top of the team and you're building it. I think that it's a North Star. It's hard to achieve this, but I think the ideal teams are one where kind of you're doing what you're best at. You can say there's 3, 4, 5 people on your team and each one of them are doing what they're best at. And probably most importantly, that in totality, those 5 functions of people doing what they're best at is all that's needed to succeed, right? So you have 5 high-performing people, each doing 1/5 of the work and each contributing at a high rate of value. I mean, that's sort of the theoretically perfect way of doing it. And those are the companies that click. I mean, those are the companies that do the best. And there's another network in your life, which is the outside network. So the team is your inside network. They help you get the work done. I mean, let's remember, business is very simple. You make promises to people, and then you get to keep those promises and you get paid for doing it. And so you have to find a group of people to help you keep the promises. Otherwise, the business doesn't go well. But the outside group is the group of people who introduce you to opportunity. So they're not necessarily your inside team, but they're still the people who put you in the path of new business. And I think the same principles apply. Finding 5 people. I often use the example, if you're a baker, you want to have in your network, you want to have a corporate events planner. You want to have a wedding planner. You want to have the guy who owns the catering hall. These are the people you need in your network to bring opportunity your way. And so both ways, your outer network, let's say 6 people who are strategically relevant to you, and your inner network, which is the promises that you're out there making to people, between all your team, you can cumulatively deliver on the promises you make. It was super oversimplification, but I mean, that's kind of all there is to it in a way.
Well, I think it's a great simplification. And actually, what I really enjoyed too, speaking of simplification, was in your latest book, which I believe is your latest book, The First Habit, you talk about kind of discovering what you're best at, finding language around that. But you also don't suggest that someone does that by themselves, that they enlist the help of others. And you even give a bit of a way for people to do that. And I'd love for you not only to share that, but tell us what you learned about yourself in that regard, because I thought that was fascinating when you reached out to others and they gave you what you felt was a bit surprising information. There you go.
So I'll say there's a couple of firsts in this book. Well, one of them is the thinness of this book. That was a first for me. I never written such a thin book. And, you know, if you write books for publishers, I know this sounds like I'm being a little harsh, but you sell books by the pound. Nobody's going to go into a bookstore, drop a 20, and walk out with a book like this and feel good about it. Even if the story can be told in 50 pages, they just want more pages. So this time I wrote the book, and I gave it the number of pages it needed. And I went even a step farther, which is I told everyone, you know, how to get the most out of the book in the first 3 pages, so they didn't even have to read the whole book. All 50 pages of it. I have it open now. I suggested that everyone email 10 people in their lives, and the email should be to 10 people that you've done business with. And the content of the email should be this: I'm interested in your opinion about something. I want to learn more about myself and how I add value to the work that I do. You and I have worked together in the past, and you've had a chance to see what I'm good at and what I like to do. Can you tell me what you think I'm best at, given the work we've done together? Period. The end. Send that to 10 people you've worked with, and you're off to the races, because you're going to get either 10 totally distinct responses, which doesn't happen too often, but does happen, or you're going to start to see that, you know, there's a theme that comes back. But the way I did this, the story you're alluding to, is I was in a little offsite work thing with 10 people I work with. And we had lined up 5 against 5. I faced one person, and, you know, we had 2 rows. In the space of a few minutes, the question each one of us asked the other was, what do you think I'm good at? And by the time I went through my list of 5 people I'd worked with for somewhere between a few months and a few years, most of them said the same thing about me. And I had never, ever, ever, ever in my life had ever thought about this, which is, they said, you're really good at asking questions. I had never thought about it. So that's weird, right? Have 4 people in that case. One guy told me I was really good at technology, and I was the chief operations officer for a virtual company. So that made all the sense in the world that I should be good at that. Unfortunately, he's the only one who said I was good at it. The other 4 said I was good at asking questions. And so I just really, this was in 2002 or 2003, I think. And I just have spent the rest of the last 13 years trying to figure out what that meant. I really have. I've written books about it. I've built businesses around it. I am paid now to ask questions, because I interview people in front of my community of business owners. And I've written books that are all based on questions. And imagine that. Imagine just someone saying something to you like, you're good at asking questions, and spending the next, so far, 13 years trying to figure out how to maximize its value in the marketplace. And it's been incredible. I can't say enough about it. And it required me to ask, right? You have to ask. It required me to listen. And then it required me to start to put it to action. And I made a lot of mistakes along the way. I continue to make mistakes, but I've just dedicated my life to saying, well, how do I maximize the value of being a good question asker in the marketplace? And I just, if people say, well, how do you make money asking questions? I mean, you know, newscasters, you know, get paid a lot of money to ask questions, right? I mean, Charlie Rose and Oprah, I mean, these people, they make a lot of money asking questions. So you can make money as a good question asker. And I'm trying to figure out what it is for me.
Well, I'm sure you've seen it in the Business Owners Council and elsewhere, where asking the right question can mean all the difference in the world. You know, I participated in peer groups. I can think of one where an ad agency principal was asking the question, how do I add more clients? I want new clients, right? And after a while, people started saying, I'm not sure that you're asking the right question. You want to grow your agency. And when you think about it, because there are different revenue streams, because there are different ways to growth, all of a sudden now, what started as a conversation with how do I prospect for new clients and how do I essentially take existing resources that I'm putting to my current clients and point them toward new ones, you had someone looking, how do I grow my company? And it became very much a customer client service conversation.
Yeah, 100%. That's a great example.
So really fast, you've seen that the power of asking really great questions and having people around you who can help you really fine tune that question. Because, you know, when we find ourselves in a situation, we get the right answer to the wrong question, that doesn't always help us a whole lot. Right.
So. You know, so I do this all day long now, but like, for example, on a monthly basis, I've got about 50 very serious heavy hitter business owners in the room. And we have one special entrepreneur that I'm interviewing, and I'm very focused on my job. My job is to ask the right questions to that. If these 50 powerful business people with staffs of their own and management teams and customers and vendors and, you know, cascading ecosystems, if they heard the answers, what might they do with that information times 50? Like, that's my challenge. I don't care if it's interesting. I just care if it unlocks an opportunity in the mind of the 50 people in the audience that they can do something about it. And then I think about the ripple effect of all that.
You know, part of what I'd love for our listeners to get here today too is a real understanding of the resources that are available to them. So if you're an entrepreneur out there, clearly there are resources and peer groups, or you could start one of your own. But, you know, specific to some things you're working on, both Bend Global Mentorship and Birthing of Giants, I'd love for you to talk about both of those and get our listeners acquainted with that.
Sure. So, and I do, excuse me, I do divide the universe into people who want to be successful and those who are already on their way. And that can sound a little harsh to people, especially if you're on the want to be side. But it's true, as you know, that no matter what level you're at, you want to get to a higher level. In fact, my research is pretty clear. Almost everybody says I'd feel pretty good or even really good if I was 2.5 times richer than I am now, or I got paid 2.5 times what I get paid now. And then they say, if I could have 10 times more, 10 times more net worth, 10 times more revenue, that would be a dream of all dreams. But if you understand that line of thinking, if you ever were to accomplish it, you still just want 10 times more. It never stops. So, you know, I have groups of people who fit in a category, which is I have a program for people with $2 million to $250 million in revenue. I have these communities I run for them. And if you're not at $2 million revenue, you're not welcome in that community. But that's not, I'm not trying to exclude you. It's just you don't want to be in the room with the wrong people, because the tools that people with a $10 million business have at their disposal are different than the tools you have. So I started a digital platform called Bend Global Mentorship, where you could essentially get the same information that my, you know, successful $2, $5, $10, $100 million guys are getting, which is, I took the interviews I had done with some of the most powerful entrepreneurs, some of the most amazing mentors, and I made them available, you know, at a fee, and you could join a community of other people who are essentially watching these lessons and learning from incredible entrepreneurs like Tony Hsieh, the founder of Zappos, and Bert Jacobs, the founder of Life is Good, and my business partner, Norm Brodsky, who's an Inc. magazine stalwart, and he's a very successful guy, just closed a deal yesterday, today, Wednesday, yesterday, for $160 million that was in the papers. Wow. So to learn from these people, because digitally, it sort of opens up all this opportunity. You know, it's very hard for Tony Hsieh from Zappos to give a lot of one-on-one time to people. He's a busy guy, but you can access him digitally. And so we sort of took his best ideas and made them available as an open platform. That's different than what I do when I run my groups, where you have to be physically in the room. Birthing of Giants is a one-week program. We go down to Duke University. We work hard. We play hard. You come out of there with some great ideas and some real improvements to your business. For me, it's always sort of time, geography, and money. You know, if you have a lot of money to spend and you can physically put yourself in the room with us, we can help you a lot. And if you can't do that, and a lot of people can't do that, you can access all the same information digitally. You do have to be a little more self-motivated, to be honest, but you have to, but you can get access to the great information. And the way I sold these guys like Tony Hsieh or Bert Jacobs or Norm on this project was simple. I basically said, hey, you wouldn't be where you are if people didn't help you. So now it's your turn to help other people. And they totally understood that argument, and there was no arm twisting involved, really.
I think that what you talk about in terms of people being at different stages is really fair. You know, and the power of peers, we talk about the fact that whether you're trying to run a business or run a marathon, it's helpful to hang around with other people who want to do that also, or who have done that. If you want to run a marathon, though, and you're just running your first one and you're hoping, hey, if I can finish somewhere four and a half, five hours, whatever it takes to get me across the finish line, that's great. If you want to finish in under 2.5 hours, that's a very different conversation. And that's a very different training regimen and all. So I think, again, it's really tied to your goals, tied to what stage you're in. It isn't that one conversation is better than the other. They're just different. And right. And I think it's you know, very fair, and I think really good advice in terms of when you talk about getting the right people in the room, that you really want to make sure you're at that same stage of things, I think. Right. You know?
And I think the challenge with mentorship is people, there's peers and then there's mentors. And so
yes.
Peers are incredibly important, and they're people who are more or less like you. Maybe they're ahead of you. Maybe they're a few years ahead of you or something, but they're on your track. And then there's mentors who have kind of done the thing you want to do. And the thing about the peer relationship, and you, of course, think about this a lot, is there has to be some equanimity in the peer relationship. There has to be equivalency. In the mentor-mentee, never forget that the reason why these people are willing to mentor us has a lot to do with their sense of legacy and nostalgia. You know, they want to share what they've learned. They want to be valued for sharing what they've learned. And yeah, for sure, you can help a mentor every once in a while in ways that you may not be so obvious. But primarily, they're giving and you're getting. And you have an obligation to do that for the next person down the line, I believe. But in a peer relationship, it's more like there's equivalency. You're trying to help each other do the same things. You should really... So I think there are questions you ask peers that you might not ask mentors. I think with peers in a business context, you should say to your peer, you should say, what are your goals? How much money do you make? How much money do you want to make? If it's you make 100 and you want to make 150, how many new clients or opportunities do you need to get there? Because if I'm going to be in a peer-to-peer relationship with you, I should somehow be aware of what's important to you and be thinking about how to help you accomplish that. And you should be doing that for me. And in a mentor-mentee relationship, you wouldn't really ask them how much money do you make, how much money do you want to make. And I think that's the distinction between those two types of relationships.
No, that's really interesting. You know, as we get near the end here, I do want to, you know, one of the things you learned about yourself is that you're really good at asking questions. So if you could come up with a question that I didn't ask you that you wish you were asked, why don't you?
Yeah. So I wrote in the book that questions are dropped into my head from, you know, some other supernatural source. So I could literally interview you for an hour nonstop with no preparation. It's just my gift. But I think one of the things I think is really important is the great skill of the future. If you want to be successful, we have a new economy, obviously. I mean, you know, if you just think about the tectonic changes happening in this country and this world, they're big. They're big. I'm not sure they're bigger than ever before, but they feel really big and dramatic. So we go from a sort of industrial economy to a knowledge economy. A lot of things are important, things are changing. And a question you could ask me is, what's the most important skill or talent that you could have in the future, given where our new economy is headed?
And your answer would be?
My answer would be learning how to pivot. That it's no longer true that, you know, you're going to learn a skill, let's say in college or even on the job training, that you can somehow keep doing that for the rest of your career, even if you move up the ladder and just keep kind of doing that thing. That in fact, the marketplace is speaking more frequently, its changes are more aggressive, and you know, and so each of us are going to be faced with these moments in our professional lives where we are told that the thing that we were good at and we're committing ourselves to is no longer as valuable as it once was. And so we will then be faced with the pivot. And so I have a 12-year-old son, and I'm obsessed with the idea of teaching him that the you know, he's going to hit a few walls in his career. And I don't know what he'll do for a living, but I want to really focus on helping him switch from one thing to another when the marketplace is really clear that it wants him to do that and to figure out how to do that thing. So if I look back at the sort of secret talent that holds together all these very successful people I've gotten to meet, it's that they knew how to make pivots when the marketplace told them, instead of saying, you know, to the world, damn you, how dare you go changing on me? They said, I hear you. There's a new way to do this. I'm going to switch and try and do it that way. And so they didn't have this sort of nostalgic, beholden quality to the thing that they knew. Instead, they said, I'm a good listener to the marketplace. When it speaks, I'm a good listener. And that's the skill of the future to teach. I don't know how to teach it, but something like that.
So being good at it, is it just a question of mindset or is there something more? If I'm going to be a really good pivoter, if you will, what's that going to take? Like how do I prepare to be better at that?
So I think there's a lot of groups that excel in entrepreneurship, and it's a funny bunch of groups because it starts off with people with a liberal arts education, surprisingly do better in entrepreneurship than, let's say, people with a technical or science degree, right? Why is that? And we could talk about that. And then we have people who have learning disabilities do better in entrepreneurship. And then we have immigrants do better with entrepreneurship. And so we have all these sort of odd groups coming together that do better with entrepreneurship. And part of it is there's this story that's sold to us, and some of it is like, you know, if you look a certain way, you come from a certain neighborhood, you have a certain background, you go to a right school, get the right education, go to the right company. Like we've been sold this whole line of goods about how our life will unfold. And we're always finding out that it's not true, that the sort of Lucy with the football and Charlie, you know? But people who had liberal arts degrees, as an example, if we're lucky, they came out of a liberal arts education and they knew how to organize their thoughts. They knew how to research things. They knew how to present ideas. So it feels to me like, in a funny way, the skill of the future is going to be just that, which is, you know, so who cares if you come out with an art history degree or sociology degree? You're probably not going to be an art historian or a sociologist, but you're probably learned how to say, you know, here's a concept. Let me research it. Let me organize my thoughts around it. Let me explain it or present it to somebody else. Pivoting is that, saying, you know, this is the feedback I've gotten. Instead of feeling shameful about what the market is telling me, because it's usually telling you that you're wrong, I'm going to be a researcher. I'm going to try and understand what happened, and I'm going to try and understand what it's told me, how I can do something differently, how I can organize my thoughts around that thing, and how I can move forward with that new information. I think that something like a liberal arts degree, there's something out of the liberal arts education that makes sense.
No, I think so too. And I think surrounding yourself with people that have different perspectives and different experiences and see the world a different way can give you those early warning signs when the marketplace is telling you something different as well.
Well, to your point about social contagion earlier, about, you know, being around people who see things differently, it's not just a nice to have what you just said, it's essential. If you surround yourself with people who see the world the way you do, you're all going to be surprised when the marketplace speaks to you. So you need to surround yourself with people who see the world differently. Here's the challenge. People who see the world differently can be really annoying because they see the world differently than you. So you're constantly butting heads with them. That's the skill you need, to surround yourself with people who see things differently. Even in spite of the fact that they frustrate you is kind of the sign that you know it's working, you know?
Well, it's hard to imagine better advice for 2017. So look, thank you so much for being part of the program today. Really appreciate what you did to make this possible.
Thank you.
And you have a great year. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Leo. Thanks to your team as well.
Thanks for joining us today. To learn more about Peer Advantage, to submit questions to Leo and our guest, and to subscribe to the Year of the Peer podcast, please visit us at leobattari.com. That's LEOBOTTARY.com. This podcast is produced by me, Randy Cantrell, hosted, of course, by Leo Battari. Music provided by Kevin McLeod, Vibe Ace, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.